Four men, masters in their fields, coming together to pontificate on science and technology. These great men, dedicated to truth, honor, and justice in the American way, are the Gizmo Sisters.
Welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 214, what Matt and I are calling the Spring Fling. And as I just said Matt's name, obviously it's me, Chris, and Matt today.
Hello.
We're eating at Mike's Nashville Hot Chicken at Austin Landing. And so you'll hear us smacking our lips and drinking soda and everything else while we're recording today. Matt and I were just talking about the fact that, frankly, there's not, at least from in my perspective from the tech world, there hasn't been a whole lot to talk about. Everybody's kind of hush-hush. Things are kind of in commodity or saturation mode, you know. And there hasn't been a major breakthrough that somebody has figured out what the next level of technology, you know. And the funny thing about technology is that, yeah, there's this enterprise technology that runs the internet and runs the cloud. I hate that term. And runs business. But that stuff is generally doesn't change a whole lot. It might get faster, but it's not, you know, it's not these major...
Or more vulnerable.
Yeah. But there's not these major technological changes that happen. It's personal technologies, laptops, cell phones, smartwatches, smart glasses, that kind of stuff. Probably the most exciting thing going on is Elon Musk and SpaceX and Tesla. I think both of his companies are probably from a wow factor. Let's move things forward. And the funny thing is neither of them are groundbreaking. They're just, it's the packaging of existing technology, you know. Although it is pretty impressive that they've created the first reusable rockets and they can land them on barges out in the ocean. I mean, look at NASA, the budget they've had for years. And
honestly, though, had they stuck with rocketry rather than the shuttle,
they would have been there.
I think they probably would have surpassed that mark.
Yeah. But you also got to look at it from the perspective that in a very small amount of time, they have built the technology and deployed it.
Was that Musk that was involved in the venture to build a space station?
I don't think that's him.
It seems like the sort of thing he would do.
Yeah.
Or at least be interested in.
I agree. He's an interesting character, you know. A lot of people liken him to Steve Jobs and Donald Trump. You know, there's a lot of marketing, a lot of whitewashing. But at the end of the day, they get stuff done.
He is certainly the Howard Hughes of our time.
Yeah. And what I'm really more interested in than either of the Tesla and the SpaceX stuff, because SpaceX really won't be interesting until we get to the point where we're mining natural resources out of asteroids, you know, and bringing that back to Earth to do other things with. You know, and then also that also puts the onus of mining and all that stuff out away from the planet, and you know, which would then alleviate some of the environmental concerns and all this other stuff. But the solar stuff is really interesting. you know. Although it is not as readily available as I think it should be, you know, his investment in, you know, the solar tiles, you know, on the roofs and stuff like that. But like the car, there's an existing political, techno-political infrastructure that exists that don't want to change. You know, electric companies will do solar as long as they control it. To me, I would like to be totally not have to rely on electric companies whatsoever. You know, my house generates enough power for what I use, and if I need more power, then I upgrade my system. You know?
Unfortunately, the reason why that doesn't work is that mindset has to be a part of the construction.
Exactly.
You're going to increase the cost of housing on the front side. It'll save you money in the long run. But until that mindset takes hold, I don't know that that's ever going to really become a reality beyond, you know, certain individuals who see that vision.
True. I actually think that you'll see that as more, I mean, I will say this. It makes sense in the Midwest and in the South where there's not lots of big cities, but it doesn't make sense in the Northeast and places where there are lots of big cities for it to be an individual. But like New York City would be a good example. If an apartment owner, apartment building owner, could put that up and provide enough electricity for all the apartments in a building, and then the tenants pay their part of that share as part of the rent, that makes perfect sense to me.
But my point there is that even in that model, what that does is it makes housing even more expensive than it already is.
But it doesn't. Because right now the issue is why it would be housing is more expensive is because there's no economy of scale. So, you know, not every building, you know, it's now the outliers and the exceptions to the rule that are getting the solar technology. It, you know, and I'm strictly talking about, you know, some kind of self-power generation type thing. And So yeah, you are loading your cost onto the construction of the property. The problem is it's not that much. I mean, to an individual homeowner, yeah, it's an extra $25,000 possible. To a business who's building a building, that's a nit. You know, even if it added an extra $500,000 to a $15 million building, it's a nit.
Well, sure. I mean, but that's not really what we're talking about. I mean, really, to truly succeed, it's not gonna really take off until homeowners recognize that getting off the power grid is the way to go.
Yeah.
I mean, and really, it's becoming a national security issue.
Absolutely.
Think that at some point somebody is going to be successful if they haven't already. I mean, I can remember the New York City blackouts after 9/11.
Oh, yeah.
And all that. I mean, you'd have thought that more people would have woke up to the possibilities of really just how on the edge we are.
Yeah.
Of Armageddon. I mean, I hate to put it in those terms, but let's face it, the American people are, for the most part, not a they're not rugged outdoorsmen anymore.
No, that's very true. Particularly both coasts. But, you know, on the flip side of it, I think that's it's where you're going to see it. It's in the middle of the country. It's where you're going to see a lot of this stuff take place and happen. Because I would say probably more so out west than the Midwest. In the Midwest, you're going to see it because because agriculture. And, you know, the United States, regardless of what anybody wants to say, the United States is the breadbasket of the world. We produce about 80% of all the food for the world. Our exports are incredible. In Ohio, you know, with all the industry that exists here, what is the number one most profitable business in Ohio? Farming. So, but those guys have to cut costs, you know, and it's pretty funny because power companies, they know it's not their best interest to generate less power. So they could care less if you made your house more efficient or made your farm more efficient. But, I mean, there's a lot of little things you have to do to get to the point where solar makes sense or alternate solar, wind, whatever. And one of those is like LED lighting. If you take an LED lamp, which will produce 60% more lumens than the equivalent compact fluorescent, because nobody uses incandescents hardly at all anymore. It uses a 20th of the electricity of that bulb. But what are the power companies like Duke Energy, when they offer you free light bulbs, they're giving you compact fluorescents, not LEDs. I mean, I've noticed that it, you know, changed almost every light in our property to LED, and it dropped our power bill almost $50 a month.
That's impressive.
Yeah. You know, and I'm looking at changing the remainder of the lights that exist to LED if I can do so.
Well, how big a property are you talking about here?
20 acres, multiple farm buildings.
Oh, okay. So you're talking about multiple structures.
Yeah. You know, we have security lights and things that have to stay on all night and everything. So, you know, my power bill is, it's funny because I get my, you know, they still build a farm like it's a residence, and they give me the thing, I get it in the mail, you know, how is your house doing versus the, now my neighbors are not powering all these outbuildings and everything else. And I'm looking and it's like, I'm like, you know, 5x what theirs is. You know, and then they give you the tips. Well, you could do this and you can do that. And it's like, that's not going to help me at all. But you know, that alone, if you had a whole neighborhood and all the lighting was switched to LED, and the city, cities have to pay electricity for, you know, street lamps and everything else. Why they're not, when they do have to go change those lamps, why they're not investing in LEDs does not make sense. Those sodium lights, which have that horrible glare, but they use them anyway. You know, out west, they've proven that the LED lights are better. They provide more light, and they're not as, they don't cause as much light pollution. You know, it's just interesting. But, you know, the thing is, it's kind of like looking at an ecosystem, or when you look at an ecology, so an ecosystem, you know, an ecological, we're looking at a technological ecosystem. And I'm not talking computers, and, you know, I'm not talking Apple versus Microsoft. I'm talking, you know, simple things like an Edison light bulb versus an LED, and, you know.
Well, when I look at those sorts of things, it's like an infrastructure problem. I mean,
the problem with looking at an infrastructure problem is so if you take it to the next step, and we'll go on to another one of Elon Musk's, you know, the electric car, which I have no problem with. You know, the battery, at least in the Teslas, the batteries are good enough that you could probably have an electric car and drive it around between Dayton and Cincinnati you know, as your daily driver, no problem. And there's enough places now that that have electronic charging stations, which shocked me. Like the DLM just down the road here has 4 electronic charging station spots. And I do notice more and more people in this area are driving Teslas. Like I'll be driving up to Wright Patterson Air Force Base, and there'll be I'll pass a Tesla or two occasionally. But the problem with them is so you have this oil industry. And the oil industry is, I'm not talking about the guys who drill oil and all that. There's another part of that industry we don't think about, and that's the guys who run the gas stations. Because, and just because a gas station says it's Shell or BP or whatever does not mean that it's actually owned by Shell or BP. It is just a branding that they apply to these gas stations for companies like Giant Oil, who own all kinds of gas stations, whether they're Shell, BP, Marathon, and their job is as retailers. You know, they negotiate to buy the gas from the real oil drillers, or the gas or oil processors who make gasoline, and then resell it to the public. And you know, they're threatened, and this is just one part of it. They're seriously threatened by electric vehicles. The oil producers know that, you know, they could switch to polymers or something else. There's a ton of things that we use crude oil for. So they're not...
Plastic isn't going anywhere.
Yeah. they're not as worried as the guys who are gasoline delivery guys. And not that they're ever going to go away completely, because, you know, we don't have electric pickup trucks and we don't have electric construction vehicles, at least not powerful enough today to, you know, make sense and the switching that. But then there's also the governmental regulation. So how do we pay for our interstates, and how do we pay for local roads and everything else? Well, that's taxes. And how do we get those taxes? We collect them as part of our gasoline. So 20 to 30 cents of every gallon of gasoline you buy, at least in Ohio, depending on where you live, and it could be more and it could be less in some places, goes to pay for the roads, whether they're local, state, or federal. And so you get rid of gasoline and people are driving electric vehicles, how do you pay for the roads? Because, you know, and legislation is slow to move to figure out how to do that.
Well, first of all, you have to stop abusing the transportation budget.
Very, very true.
I mean, that's, you want to talk about the thing that aggravates me more than anything from a policy standpoint. Abusing funds that have been set aside to accomplish a certain task that never gets really done the way it should be done. I just, you know, we can talk about that, but it's not being done right now.
You're very correct.
So, I mean, I say bring it on, just so we can blow up the current process.
Well, and you know, that's the problem. A lot of these processes need to be blown up. It's kind of like what I always said back when we had the financial downturn and the government bailed out General Motors and Chrysler. I'm like, you know, I firmly believe there's no business that's too big to fail. And the problem is so here's some consequences of, and this relates to the legislation. So we bailed out General Motors Corporation. They would have gone out of business. And so everybody's, you know, and then everybody claims, well, if they'd gone out of business, then all these people would be out of work. Well, General Motors had been liquidating assets for years, so there's not that many employees that have been out of work. But because they were bailed out, they were able to effectively continue a monopoly. And so some new companies like Fisker Motors and other guys who were bringing innovation in the market were basically pushed out of the of being able to do business because of that. I mean, that affects the Dayton area greatly, because General Motors had one of the most productive plants in all of General Motors was in Moraine, Ohio. And because of politics, that plant got shut down over a plant in Linden, New Jersey, which was one of the least productive, that happened to build the same body style, a vehicle. Fisker Motors tried to buy that plant. But because General Motors was saved, they made it almost effectively impossible for Fisker to get the approvals and buy the plant. I mean, and so now, you know, they've had to split that property up when it could have brought a whole bunch of jobs back to the area that before GM started having problems, they had closed the plant anyway. So, you know, that's just called a demographic shift, you know.
Well, I mean,
but that policy is just like that. That should have, we should have let it blow up, just like we should let the whole issue with how do we fund our roads and stuff blow up.
It really is the circle of life. I mean, companies are not, capitalism doesn't work that way.
Exactly.
I mean, it really doesn't. A company is supposed to be born, mature, and die. So that the next generation of whatever it is can be innovated again. Too big to fail is one of the dumbest things government could ever buy into.
Oh yeah.
At any level.
But see, that's pure socialism.
Oh yeah, it totally is.
You know, that switching topics a little bit, or a segueing topic. So, pure socialist. So, have you been keeping up with the whole Brexit situation?
A little here, a little there. What are you hearing?
Well, just as a recap, so it's kind of funny. I've been listening to a lot of things, been reading a lot about. Yeah, I'm very interested in it. I mean. If you've ever been to Great Britain, what you realize is that up until probably the mid-80s, U.S. and Great British history are the same history. and particularly the farther back you go, you realize how much you share, because eventually you get before 1776, and there is no America. We were all British subjects. And so, you know, and culturally, they're probably the closest country in the world culturally to the United States. Because most of our culture derived from them, whether people want to admit it or not. And so, you know, it was strange back in the 70s when the idea of the European Union started. And, you know, Great Britain was one of the first five signatories. But at that time, it was not so economically entwined.
It was supposed to be the United States of Europe.
Yes.
Which was a laudable idea.
Yeah, but you can't do that with a bunch of socialist countries. You know, it's not like the state of California has a budget deficit and they can't figure out how to do this, that, or the other. And they come to Ohio and they go, well, you guys are going to have to bail us out. I haven't seen that happen yet.
No, but what they're doing is they're going to the federal government, which is the same thing.
In a way. They're making the people bail them out. But, you know, the problem is we haven't, as bad as I consider California,
Calexit failed this week.
Yes, I did. Calexit. Yeah, the guy quit.
Yeah.
Talk about a short attention span. But let's go back. So they start this whole European Union thing for economic purposes. And originally it really started out as more like a NAFTA type thing. We want to make it easier to trade between European countries and all this stuff. And then it started getting into this whole legal thing, you know. And so now people can move between the countries like their states and all that sort of stuff. Well, that was great as long as their states in part of a greater union. But they weren't. They're countries and essentially a big trade pact. And so, you know, you get people, now you're at the crisis we are today, so you have countries like Greece who have no industry whatsoever, and, you know, and Spain, and so they're a drain economically on the rest of the European Union, and then you get people like Angela Merkel, whatever her stupid name is. It starts taking all these hostile immigrants into the country, and you know, and then letting them move around everywhere. And I mean, the social unrest in Europe, even though they're not, the media is not calling that, is huge. You know, because unfortunately, I'm going to take all these refugees in who don't have the same values and everything that we have, and we're just going to give them the keys to the kingdom. And so what are the refugees trying to do? They're trying to turn the Europe into what they left. And eventually it won't be any better than it was, you know, than where they came from. And so, you know, the citizens of Great Britain vote, we want to leave. We're calling, they're leaving the European Union, so we're calling it Brexit, the British exit. But what's funny is, in all the years, in the 30 or so years that the European Union has been around and had a legislative body and all this, they never put any plans in place other than the Article 52. When a country votes and signs the Article 52, which means they're leaving the European Union, there's nothing else legislatively, because they never thought anybody would ever leave.
Well, to be honest, the United States has done the same thing. You have to fight a war and hope you win it.
Yeah.
Which...
Actually, there are some things. I mean, if you have the original Constitution, you know, it doesn't give a lot of detail, but it does say what happens and how the process is supposed to work. And then we have a couple amendments that actually address... unfortunately, the amendments kind of counteract what some of the Constitution actually said you could do, which was fight a war and leave. But that being said, at least we have that. They have nothing. And so once Article 52 is signed, Great Britain has 2 years to negotiate everything with all of the member countries of the European Union.
Why would you? If I'm Great Britain, what economic advantage is there to doing business in Greece? There is none.
There isn't. Well, that's the thing, though. You have people who want to be friends with everybody, and you know, or they. When it's like when you break up with somebody and they go, "Let's be friends," you know. And the reality of it is you can't always do that. As a matter of fact, it's more rare to be friends than it is to be enemies. There's a reason you broke up. So that being said, you know, I've read a lot, I've thought about a lot about it, and I will say this, Great Britain is doing the government over there is actually doing a pretty good job of handling it, as far as I can tell. The only thing that's kind of a shocker this week is that Theresa May is calling for general elections, and this is more of a political move on her part than it is anything that's relevant to the Brexit and the stability of the government. Now, they're claiming that the general elections that they will now have in June, because her party and herself, they will just sweepingly be reelected into their position unless something drastic happens. But basically, it extends her term for another 2 years. So instead of 2020 being the end of, you know, when the new elections happen, it happens in 2022. So that way, what it is they're building in fudge factor, you know, in case public opinion and everything goes poorly during these 4 years of Brexit. But that being said, I agree with you. I could see, if I have 2 years to do all this, there's, 28 member countries in the European Union, something like that. I would concentrate on the ones that matter. Probably France, probably Germany. Probably, is there anybody else who really counts?
Not really.
You know, and that's probably all I would concentrate on. Get whatever needs to be done settled there.
Those two are what I would consider the must-haves.
Yeah.
Anything else you get beyond those two is icing on the cake.
Yeah, well, in a lot of the small countries, and particularly ones who are in positions like Greece, why bother? Just wait until you're two, you know, put them on the end, once you get the important ones done, and then your secondary set, whatever, then go back to them. But the other thing that there's a real possibility of that I think is probably would be a boon more to world economics is, and I'm fairly certain this is going to happen, is we're going to have, you know, NAFTA is going to be redone. And whatever NAFTA becomes, I think will include Great Britain. And part of the reason that will happen is it will give a new, the United States will want it because it will give a new market for goods that are produced in the United States. Great Britain will want it because not only is it a place where they can get new quality goods that aren't always made in China, it'll also be a market for them to sell their stuff, the things that they have. And they do have some good agricultural output. They have some unique luxury items that people, you know, that there's a market in the United States to buy. So economically, that would be good. And, you know, I would assume Canada would be drawn up in that as well. Mexico is probably sitting on the bubble. Unless they pay for the wall, they're not going to be part of it. You know, we built the Panama Canal. I don't know why we can't do that across the border of Texas. Widen the Rio Grande out.
Some piranha and some sharks with freaking laser beams on the head. Yeah, I'm with you.
Make it wide enough. It's hard to swim, you know. Fill it with salt water. I don't know. It's funny because all of this is related. You know, the Brexit in Britain, what it can do for the United States, what the United States can do for Britain, all the United States tech companies, you know, the markets that they would get by having direct access to Great Britain without paying any tariffs through the European Union. And, you know, it would probably be a boon. We do pay tariffs, not high ones, but it would probably be a boon even to our business with the European Union as markets, because we would now have a way to funnel it much easier through to there, because we could use Great Britain as a shipping hub.
Plus, let's face it, the European Union has been kind of a pain in the hindquarters for a lot of American tech companies from a legal standpoint.
Well, the whole, we don't want backdoors of encryption, or we want backdoors of encryption. And, I mean, even the most liberal people I know don't want that. You know, they still see privacy as a key thing. And, you know, that Germany and France, that's their big thing. But, you know, the funny thing about all of this is Great Britain is going to be successful doing this. They're going to leave. Article 52, it's going to happen. It would take years to bring them back in and all this other stuff, you know. But, you know, France is on the edge of doing the same thing.
And why wouldn't they?
And if France goes, that means Germany's not going to hang around. And then what happens if all three of your major economic powers
leave? That makes Italy and Spain the big boys in that order. And let's face it, that ain't enough.
No, not at all. Well, and, you know, and part of it's cultural, too. The farther south you get in Europe, the cultural propensity for 4-day work weeks and siestas every day, and, you know, it's totally different than the American work ethic. The farther north you get, the closer you get. And so, you know, if your two major economic powers are doing that, what will end up happening is Switzerland and the Scandinavian countries will all of a sudden become the major powers, because, you know, at least some innovation and things come out of there. Historians have talked years about how, you know, the decline and decadence of both the culture and economy of Europe, because they're old countries that have existed for a long time, and, you know, that they don't feel that they have to produce it. But that's a cultural thing. That's not a realistic thing, you know. The other thing that's interesting is as we see China's economy, which is totally fake, if you believe that they don't manipulate their market just to make it look like there's something going on, I mean, it's not as bad as North Korea where they... but it's pretty close. But you know, India is going to overtake their economy. They're going to overtake most of the manufacturing they do. And probably a good portion of South America is going to do that too. You know, Brazil is slowly becoming the next China or the next India in the sense of manufacturing companies, you know, who build high-tech things moving out, you know. And you're going to continue to see that happen. And what little innovation these people have or what little motivation to work in these cultures, if they don't change what's going on, it's going to totally devastate their economies. It'll be 10 times worse than Greece is right now. And Spain's not far from being like Greece, and Italy's not far behind them. They're the reason Great Britain is leaving the European Union. Because there's the economic disadvantages outweigh the advantages of being able to do business with France and Germany.
And really, you want to put that into perspective of the United States and Europe.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like... I mean, which states are not performing economically in this country? I mean, it's really the same thing.
Yeah.
Thought process. What good is it for Ohio to do business with California if California isn't producing?
A better example would be, what's the reason for Ohio to do business with Michigan?
Well, yeah, exactly.
You know,
although Ohio's not exactly carrying their weight, depending upon which you choose to...
I totally agree. But then again, the big difference is Ohio is not a sovereign country in and of itself.
Well, yeah, and I think that's kind of the point.
Yeah.
The whole United States and Europe thing was never going to work because...
Nobody wanted to give up.
Take Texas aside.
Yeah.
There isn't any other state in the Union that thinks they're big enough, bad enough to be their own country. California, if you think about it, but in reality, they don't have the attention span.
Exactly.
Or the... desire to work.
Even if you looked at Texas, you don't have the population.
There's an awful lot of people in Texas.
There are.
That are fed up with the crap like going on in California.
Yeah.
You get enough of those people.
Yeah.
And there is an undercurrent in this country of dissatisfaction with the way things are going in this country.
But the problem is so... Because Ohio, we've had a string of terrible governors. Everybody got to see John Kasich and his abhorrent performance in the trying to run as a conservative, as a liberal. But, so, you know, Ted Strickland, Kasich, you're looking at what's going on and we've seen an exodus of people. We have more people who are leaving our state than we have moving in.
Well, yeah.
But I think a lot of that is not so much the overall political climate as it is more of... It's a direct result of the political climate, but it's more of a result of, you know, people move where the jobs are. And at some point, Texas isn't going to have enough jobs for the number of people that want to move there. I mean, they kind of already are in that situation with the illegal immigration and everything else. Now, and there might be a boon for several years, 20 years, 30 years, you know, as they build a wall and they hire guards and they, you know, they do that. But at some point, that becomes untenable too, you know, or... You know, it's what I said. It's this migrating demographic. You know, economics good over here, so we move. You know, jobs are good here, so people move in.
Well,
it's kind of like the Raleigh-Durham area. You know, the Research Triangle.
Yeah.
you know, in the late 90s and early 2000s, that area was hot because there was a lot of economic opportunities, and so a lot of people moved there and everything, and now it's kind of cooling off, and you're seeing...
But that's because IBM sold out to the Red Chinese.
True.
Face it. Raleigh-Durham was IBM. IBM was Raleigh-Durham.
Yeah.
You sell off the everything that's hardware. I mean, really, does IBM make anything anymore?
Not really.
I mean,
they make the power servers, but that's about it.
I remember when I worked as a contractor for them. I don't remember who it was. It was one of the regional manager types. I was like, you know, we really don't make any money selling this stuff. We're a finance company now. You know, this is... How many of our manufacturing companies have become this?
Yeah.
We've allowed our economy to evolve into a service industry, but we don't make anything.
But, you know, it's... I think part of that, too, though, is... We've talked about this in the past, that whole lie of the American dream. There is an American dream. But it has been corrupted that everybody should go to college, everybody's suited for college. And frankly, there are a lot of colleges that shouldn't exist because they're producing graduates who can't get jobs in the fields because there's too many jobs in that field. I mean, as much as I love fine arts, we don't need as many fine arts schools in the United States as exist because to actually work in fine arts, almost nobody in fine arts works in the fine arts industry because there's no money in it. There's no jobs to be, you know, for things to be made. It's a romantic idea, but it doesn't exist in reality. But going away from that, you know, it kind of goes back to Mike Rowe's mantra about, you know, technical training and technical jobs and how that's... Culturally, I mean, it's slowly turning around, but culturally, we've told people to quit being plumbers and tool makers and electricians and all these skilled trades that are required to support manufacturing. The other thing we've done is we've let labor unions get out of control. Because what has happened is labor unions encouraged a culture of mediocrity, if not slovenliness, in your work attitude. So U.S. companies, and this started in the 70s, U.S. companies started getting beat out by Japanese companies, not because we couldn't have competed, but because they had a work ethic, and we didn't at the manufacturing level. And that's why we don't manufacture. And, you know, and at the point we are today, there is, it's not total truth, but there's a lot of truth to what Tim Cook has said when, you know, he was criticized about why Apple wasn't manufacturing a whole lot here. And, you know, there are certain skilled trades that we don't even think about because there are newer skilled trades that have come up with the electronics industries that in the United States, you could fill a classroom or two with the number of the skilled trades that we have in the United, of the people in these highly electronic skilled trades for manufacturing electronics, and you can go to India and China, and they fill football fields full of these people.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but...
Now, can we build that up? Yes.
Yeah, but what I'm about to get to, though, is how do you build that up? I would think that back in the day, what an American manufacturing company would have done was bring in people, teach them how to do it on the job.
But see, that's not what they want to do today. That's, you know, and I give Trump props on this, that, you know, for years we've been bringing in people on H-1B visas to take jobs that we could have trained people for. We had kids graduating from college and been able to do. Why?
It's cheaper.
Yeah, because we didn't have that. They were temporary workers. We didn't have to pay all the benefits and all this other stuff. Yeah. But it really wasn't cheaper in the long run. It was cheaper on the short term.
But let's face it. The short term is really all that matters.
True, because that's how they manage today. It's they don't look more than 12 months out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these companies are at the point where they may not survive long enough to matter. I mean, the technology changes so often.
Yes. I mean, we talk about that, you know, and in the tech sector, you know, it is, in many cases, you know, things come and go on a blip. I mean, a good example is netbooks. Tablets replaced netbooks within 18 months, you know. Started an industry and killed it within 18 months.
Well, yeah.
But that being said, you know, the companies who produce these technologies still exist, and they've been around for a long time.
Yeah, but then they have to innovate, which, let's face that. If you don't have employees that are capable of doing that or want to do that,
yeah.
And the reason why they don't want to do that or are incapable of doing that is these companies are not taking the risk on the front end to train these people so that they're like,
well, what,
this is what you need to do.
What you have, what ended up happening is a lot of companies followed, we're going to go back to the IBM model.
Sure.
Which IBM, for years, even when I got out of college, I had an opportunity to go work for IBM, and they were going to train me to be a programmer. And they were training me to program the way they wanted me to program, as opposed to sending me to school, training me to be a programmer, and then coming in and saying, these are the requirements, this is what we want built, and then letting me figure out how to build it.
Yeah.
You know.
But again, that's a risk. And to be honest, I mean, American companies used to take those kinds of risks.
Oh, absolutely.
And be very innovative. Well, do that anymore.
The auto industry is a good example. Every car, whether it's made by Toyota, General Motors, or Ford, or whoever, almost all look alike. That they have a different nameplate on them, but I mean, the shapes of the cars, and there's no innovation. Nobody's willing to take a risk and build something that.
That's almost due to government regulation as well.
It is. I mean, it's not just them. But I mean, there's leeway. They could. Somebody could figure out how to do something a little bit, you know. I mean, and before Chevy was bailed out, they tried to bring the Bel Air back and have the Bel Air convertible. And Ford tried to bring the Thunderbird back and have a more modern, safe version of the classic look Thunderbird, which is a risk, you know. When you see those driving around today, you can actually tell what car that is and who it's made by. In a way, even though it was done through capitalism and government regulation, we've ended up with an auto industry that's almost totally exact like the old communist Soviet auto industry, where a Yugo looked just like the Russian built, because guess what? All the cars you were told to build were made by how to build them by the government. So guess what? They all looked alike. They mostly all had interchangeable parts.
I mean, that's really not too far off from where we got in America.
You're right. Well, you know, we're not going to solve that today.
No.
We probably want to solve it tomorrow, but maybe by Saturday.
Maybe.
So we want to hear from you guys. And so send us feedback at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. And we'll see you on the digital flip side.
Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.